This is our second lecture about the common ion effect. Last time we discussed the general idea of what's going on in this lab, that we have the two different solutions that we're going to prepare. We're going to take the calcium iodate solid that we prepared previously, divide that up into two portions. One portion will be dissolved in pure water. One portion will be dissolved in calcium nitrate. What we're trying to see is if that affects the amount of iodate that's going to dissociate in solution. What we need to focus on today is titration, because we are going to be trying to determine what that concentration of iodate is. The way that we're going to be doing it is through titration. This is a redox titration, but to review titration, I'm going to bring in a lot of examples from acid-base titration. For example, there are these terms endpoint and equivalence point that you've probably heard of before, but we need to talk about what the difference between those two things is, what the significance of each of those two things is. We're going to be dealing with primary and secondary standards, which is terminology that you had hopefully gotten in Chem 1A. And so I'm going to be bouncing back and forth between acid-base and redox titration examples, again, because the acid-base examples might be simpler, but they might be more familiar. But the end goal of today's discussion is going to be to talk about specifically the titration you're going to do to analyze your iodate solutions. So as a way of review, why don't we start out with these terms, equivalence point and end point, or even before that, let's just make sure we know what is the purpose of a titration. What kind of result do you expect from a titration? Concentration of some sort of solution, right? In an acid-base titration, we would take an acid and a base, react them with each other, neutralize each other. In a redox titration, we have a reducer and an oxidizer. There's a third type of titration called complexometric titration, where you have a metal center that gets surrounded by one or more what are called ligands, and that combination has a certain stoichiometry to it that you can determine through titration. But essentially then, you're using that stoichiometry to come up with concentration. When you're doing a titration, we do have the end point, we do have the equivalence point. What is the difference between those two terms? Okay, so the end point is something that you can see. We're doing visual titrations. So in the example of an acid-base reaction, we have an indicator that changes color. The most common indicator would be phenylphthalein. That changes from clear when it's acidic to pink when it goes into slightly basic solutions. So it's not exactly at pH 7. It's more around pH 8 or so. But still, it's used most commonly in acid-base titrations. That visual clue that you're done with the titration, we relate that to the endpoint, but the endpoint is technically when you have equal moles of those reactants that have participated in solution. That is, of course, adjusted for stoichiometry. So again, an example for that, if you have an acid-base titration between sulfuric acid and sodium hydroxide, each unit of sulfuric acid is going to dissociate into two H pluses, but sodium hydroxide is only going to dissociate to give you one OH minus. So in order to have enough of the hydroxide to neutralize the sulfuric acid, you have to have two times the moles of sodium hydroxide for that number of moles of acid. So the equivalence point is when you have equal moles of the compounds. Let me write down these definitions, and then let's talk about why those two things are not exactly the same thing. All right, so first, equivalence point, or let's start with end point first. The end point is the visual indication that a titration is complete. and we presume at the end point that we have reached the equivalence point, which is when equal moles of the reagents have reacted again, adjusted for stoichiometry. Since I'm talking about the equivalence point, let me write down explicitly an equation. In this case, we are taking an oxidizer, reacting it with a reducer. And at the equivalence point, we have that the number of moles of these two things should be equal. To somehow express the idea of stoichiometry, I'm going to arbitrarily put in this variable S. If we had the sulfuric acid sodium hydroxide example, that S would be 2 if we were trying to get the correct number of moles of sodium hydroxide from the moles of sulfuric acid. Now, depending on our exact reaction, maybe that S goes on one side of the equation versus the other. So it's not that we're blindly following this equation. I'm just, again, trying to express that there's some stoichiometry involved. Just to make the discussion simpler, let's presume that there's a one-to-one stoichiometry between the things reacting in solution. Well, we don't normally measure moles directly because we don't normally have solids if we're dealing with solutions. So instead of moles, we could use volume, and then what other unit? Molarity. Because if you take the volume of solution, which is easy to measure, and if you have molarity, which is in terms of liters per solution, well, those units cancel out, they'll give you moles, and so we get a variation of the M1 V1 equals M2 V2 equation that I'm sure you've seen in the past. In this case, the molarity of the oxidizer times the volume of the oxidizer will be the molarity of the reducer by the multiplied by the volume of the reducer. Three of these things we know. One of the solutions we're going to know its concentration of. Both of the solutions that we use, we're going to measure the volume of. And so if we know three of the four variables, that means we're going to be able to solve for the fourth variable, which is concentration, which is, again, the point of a titration. So why is it that the endpoint, which is the visual clue that the titration is done, why is that different from the equivalence point? Why are they not automatically the same thing? Yeah? If we were having difficulty determining exactly when that color change occurred, then yes, maybe there's a subjective element. And for acid-base titrations, at least, there's an alternative method where we don't use an indicator system at all. We use a pH probe where then we're able to construct a titration curve. And from that, we can determine when the equivalence point had occurred. But let's say it's not an observer error per se. Yes? Yes, it is. You're on the totally right track. The point was made that, yes, the equivalence point normally occurs before the end point. And that's because not necessarily that you can't see that endpoint slash equivalence point occurring. It's that you can't control the size of that last drop that you put in solution. Say, for example, we put that very last drop, which, again, going back to an acid-base example, specifically that phenolphthalein example. If you had that acid in a beaker that you were swirling around that's already had that phenolphthalein in it, it's clear at this point because it's an acid, but then you're adding the base in drop-wise, and slowly as you add it in, it gets it starts to change colors. It'll go pink momentarily. You keep swirling, the color disappears. Eventually, add that very last drop, where when you add it and then you carefully stir it, the solution retains its color. How do you know that particular drop that you added was exactly the right size? What if you really only needed half of that drop to reach the end point? I mean, the equivalence point. Well, you overstepped the equivalence point because you could control the volume exactly. Now, that percent error may be tiny. In fact, the error because of the size of the drop might sometimes be smaller than what error you have due to precision of the glassware that you're using. But still, that means in theory, the equivalence point is not exactly the same thing as the end point. So normally we assume the two to be about the same because, again, the error is usually quite small. But if we care about that error, then that might be why we use a different approach to establish concentration. So, because the size of a drop cannot be exactly controlled, it is likely that during a titration, the equivalence point will be very slightly exceeded by the time the end point is reached. And to simplify what I had said out loud earlier, this means that the last drop might have been larger than needed. So we are doing a visual titration today. We are presuming that end point, when we see the color change occur, we're going to assume that that's close enough that we know that we've reached the equivalence point. I'll show you more about the equations related to that equivalence point next lab lecture when I go over the calculations for the lab. So today I just want to talk more about titration because we are preparing a couple of different solutions today because we need to standardize the compound that we're going to use to analyze our iodate solutions. So sodium thiosulfate is the reducing agent that we're going to use to titrate against the iodate indirectly, that iodate coming from the solid that we're going to dissolve in the two different beakers. Thiosulfate's got a problem to it, though. And let's do just a quick review of some terminology. What does hygroscopic mean? Likes to absorb water from just even the open atmosphere. So it doesn't have to be in physical contact. It doesn't have to be a liquid that's directly touching the stuff. It could just be out in air. What if the stuff was so hygroscopic that it could keep absorbing water from the surrounding environment and turn into a solution? Does anybody happen to remember the term to describe that? It's deliquescent. Since you have the same lab text, if you go back to the hydrate lab from Chem 1A, it's got some of that terminology related to hydrates and such defined there. Deliquescent is exactly what sodium thiosulfate is. If you were to open up the container, leave it open for a long period of time, you'd come back with a puddle of stuff in it. It turned itself into solution by absorbing water. Because of that, we have to somehow determine the concentration of thiosulfate before we use it, And that's why we're going to be using a primary standard. So what is a primary standard versus a secondary standard? Well, there's kind of a meaning from those words primary, secondary that we can guess at. I can give you a physical example of a primary standard. If you think about the metric set of units, you know, how do we define a kilogram? How do we define a meter? Well, in the old days, you could say, it was done directly, where there is a kilogram, a mass, that's sitting inside of a jar, that's inside of a jar, that's inside of a jar, that's inside of a safe somewhere outside of Paris, I think. And it used to be that that was the standard, meaning that every once in a while it would be wheeled out and very carefully treated and put on some kind of very precise balance to verify, yes, this is a kilogram. And since it is the kilogram, then all other balances are calibrated relative to it. Or at least I think something like that used to occur. And there are bodies out there that govern standards, because if you have mass, which you have the mass of an expensive metal, then you really care if that mass measurement is accurate. Now, because it is a physical object, though, there may be problems with it. What if somehow it decomposes over time? Maybe its mass only changes really slowly, but any change in the standard's not a good thing. So there's been an effort to redefine the meter and the second and other physical constants in terms of atomic properties, since those, in theory, aren't going to change. But the point of all this is that you have some reference point that you say that is the accepted figure, and then you compare other things to it. Now, let's take that acid-base titration. Let's talk about a chemical example. If you can recall the vinegar titration that you did back in Chem 1A, you didn't just take vinegar and titrate it with sodium hydroxide directly, or hopefully didn't, because sodium hydroxide suffers from the same problem that thiosulfate does, meaning that hydroxide, if you leave it out in open atmosphere, is going to turn into a puddle of aqueous sodium hydroxide solution. So you can't just measure out the sodium hydroxide, throw it into a beaker, make a solution out of it, because even during the measurement of that solid sodium hydroxide, it's absorbed water and no longer your measurements are accurate. So you took the sodium hydroxide and reacted it with some other compound first. KHP happens to be the compound, potassium hydrogen phthalate. It was the primary standard. Why was it a good primary standard? Because it wasn't hygroscopic. And it also happened to have similar reactivity to your real goal, which was acetic acid. So you made a solution of KHP, which you assumed was the correct value. That means it was the primary standard. You then reacted reacted sodium hydroxide with that, so you could establish sodium hydroxide's concentration. That now makes sodium hydroxide the secondary standard, because you didn't calculate it, you calibrated it relative to the primary standard. You then took that sodium hydroxide to do the rest of your analyses. So one other difference between primary and secondary standards is that the primary standard, you don't use it often in direct analysis. And you may not be able to use it in direct analysis. KHP is an acid. Acetic acid is an acid. You can't react an acid with an acid to do a titration, not normally. So the primary you use to establish some other reference, which that gets consumed when you do the analysis. Let me define these terms, primary and secondary standard, and then let's talk about what in this lab is the primary versus the secondary standard. So the primary standard it is the reference compound used to establish any subsequent concentrations in your titration, whether that be establishing the secondary standard's concentration or indirectly then determining the concentration of what you're really analyzing for. The secondary standard, again, was something that you don't calculate. You calibrate it against that primary standard, and it, the secondary standard, is the thing normally consumed or used in analysis. For this experiment, the primary standard is potassium iodate. And the reason it's the primary standard is because it is exactly the same compound that you're going to be analyzing for. And so therefore, since the compound you're analyzing for is iodate and it reacts with the thiosulfate, that's why we're using a standard solution of potassium iodate as the primary standard. We are able to do this because the iodate is not hygroscopic, not reactive, just in air. So as we measure its mass, we can be confident about that measurement. Since we're measuring about 100 milligrams of the material, and since we have decimilligram balances, that means we're going to have 4 significant figures in our mass measurement. We're going to use a volumetric flask in order to prepare the solution, which I'll comment on solution preparation in just a second. But that means that we'll also have 4 significant figures in our volume measurement at least. So since molarity is moles divided by volume, and since moles comes from mass, and since both our mass measurement and volume measurement had 4 significant figures in it, that means our molarity is going to have 4 significant figures in it, which means we've got a really good solution. That's a lot of sig figs, considering that if you're using the normal little microburettes, that's only 2 sig figs. So we get a nice primary standard solution. So in terms of reactivity, again, this is the same compound. To be analyzed. And the big deal about it, it is not hygroscopic. So that means we get an accurate, and in this case also precise, mass. What's the secondary standard? The compound that's really going to be used in analysis, which is the sodium thiosulfate. Why must it be standardized, meaning reacted against that primary standard? It is hygroscopic to the point it is deliquescent. Thank you. So now that I've identified the two solutions that we need to make, the primary standard, the secondary standard, let me tell you how we're going to do the solution preparation. The directions tell you for the potassium iodate to use as close as possible to 0.107 grams of the solid in 100 milliliters total volume. When I started to explain this portion this morning, I accidentally wrote at first in 100 milliliters of water. But that's not going to be true. If you were to take 100 milliliters of water, measure it out, then throw a solid into it, that solid is going to very slightly change the volume of the solution compared to the volume of water that you start with. So in other words, if you had 100 milliliters of water, you're not necessarily going to end up with 100 milliliters of solution by including that solid. So whenever you need to prepare something in terms of a specific molarity, you start out with that solid, you fill up with water, and you make sure that you only fill up to that volume point that you want. We're going to do that in this case with a volumetric flask. Volumetric flask has normally a calibration line that is written, etched in somewhere on the neck of the flask. If I zoom in then, we want to fill it in such a way where the solution comes up to the appropriate level right at that calibration mark. Now, the liquid level, however, is not going to be flat. You will see what is known as a meniscus. What causes the shape of water in a glass tube to have the meniscus in this form, where it's sort of reaching out and crawling up the sides of the glass? What was that? So you all have to understand, I stand all the time right under an air conditioner vent. So unless you talk with the same emphasis that I do, I can't hear you all. So if you mumble, then it sounds just like that to me. Yes? So in other words, there's some kind of intermolecular attraction between the water and the sides of the glass, correct? Which is why the water is trying to crawl up it. If instead you had mercury, which was inside the tube, it would end up forming a concave, I guess you would call that, curve, because the mercury ends up being much more attracted to itself than the surrounding glass. Glass on the surface has oxygen-hydrogen bonds, which are exactly the type of bonds that are in water, which is why water ends up being so attracted to the glass and crawls up it. Mercury is a metal that doesn't have anything to do with those oxygen-hydrogen bonds, and so the shape of the meniscus, in other words, is going to depend on what kind of substance you have and what the tube that it's in is made of. The reason I'm pointing all of this out is that if you're going to do this correctly, you have to get it so that that meniscus is just barely touching the line. If you're filling this up and you even get just one little drop over that line, you have to dump the whole solution out and start over again. Because if you're doing it the correct way, where you start with the solid in the container, then as you're adding the water, some of it's going to automatically start mixing. And so even if you're trying to add the water in carefully because you get some mixing, then if you go even a little bit over the line, you can't simply remove some of that solution because it's already started to mix. And if you removed it, then you'd have no idea how many moles you really had, so you've got to be careful about the way that you fill this up. I'm pointing all of this out because it's going to be one lucky volunteer that gets to make the solution for the entire class. because it is 100 milliliters that you need of the solution, and that's just barely enough for all of us to use. I say just barely enough because there's 30 of you, and you each individual student need to do 3 titrations of your standard iodate solution against the thiosulfate solution you're going to prepare. Let me give this some context. Every student will do 3 types of titration. The standardization, which is what I'm talking about now, the iodate solution you're preparing and testing. That's one type of titration. You then have that solid that you made last time that you're going to split up and make solutions out of. You're going to titrate each one of those solutions. So that's your second and third type of titration. So standardization, testing one solution, testing the second solution, each one of those titrations, you're doing 3 times. Why? Because if you only do it once, how do you have any idea that your value is correct? If you only do it twice and the values don't agree with each other, then how do you have any idea which one to believe? If you do it thrice, then at least you're going to hope that 2 of the values are going to match. And even if your third one doesn't, then you've got some ability to say, well, this is most likely the answer. So we always do everything in triplicate, not per se for busy work's sake, but to get relevant data. So we're making 100 milliliters total of the solution. There's 30 of you. If you follow the procedure, you use 1 milliliter exactly of this solution for each titration. So 30 times 3 is 90 milliliters, which means we got a little bit left over in case one or two people make a mistake in their titrations. Now, let me write this down about preparing a solution of fixed molarity, because I know that's a Chem 1A topic, but you still need to know it because some of you are going to be making solutions in the future. To prepare a solution of fixed molarity, start with the solid in the flask. Then carefully fill. Up to the appropriate total volume. With the solvent. And again, let me say what I had said about order of addition, that if you were to take whatever volume of solvent, meaning let's say you needed 100 milliliters of solution, and instead you started with 100 milliliters of solvent, adding the solid to it would end up with more than that 100 milliliters of solution, which means you get an inaccurate result, which is why this is the way that we have to prepare the solutions. This is one of the 2 solutions. It's the only one you have to prepare carefully. The next solution, you can be somewhat sloppy about how you prepare it, because the next solution is the thiosulfate, which is hygroscopic anyways, so you don't have to be as careful either with your mass or your volume measurements, because you're going to react it. You're going to standardize it and find out what the correct concentration is anyways. Now, based on how much you're going to be using in this lab, which it looks like it's about 2 milliliters for the standardization at least. If the iodate solutions also have roughly that same concentration, then 2 milliliters times the 3 types of titrations times the 3 runs that you're going to do, let's see, that's 6 times 3, that's 18 milliliters, correct? If we had 4 people using that solution, that means we should use 76 milliliters, which means there should be enough left over in case you had to use more than 2 milliliters, if I did all my math right. And so what I'm saying is that groups of 3 or 4 can share one of these 100 milliliter solutions that the text next has you create. There's no reason for each of you make 100 milliliters of solution, since that's that much more waste that we're just going to have to end up disposing, which means cost. So for the sodium thiosulfate, it is 0.5 grams of that thiosulfate. Plus, and this might not have been obvious without looking back at the previous procedure, which I think I had mentioned in class, but yes, there is a numerical mismatch in your manual where it keeps telling you in the current experiment to look back at experiment 12. But that's the wrong number. It's experiment 9, which is the redox titration. If you read back over that redox titration procedure, it mentions that the thiosulfate solution, if it's going to be used for more than a week, we need to add a stabilizer to it. And our past experience tells us to add that even if we're just storing it for a couple of days. So, along with the half gram of the thiosulfate, you'll also have 0.005 grams, which that's 5 milligrams, of sodium carbonate. These you can add to about 100 milliliters of water because, yes, you're going to get a small inaccuracy in your volume, but again, it doesn't matter because you can't believe the mass that you're measuring anyways because the stuff's so hygroscopic. You also don't need a volumetric flask. You can use just a beaker because no point in measuring exactly the 100 milliliters. Again, because it doesn't really matter. When I say it doesn't matter, you don't want to take any random amount of the thiosulfate, just throw it in water and say you're done. So these are guidelines you want to be close to, but you can be less careful. That's why it said 0.5 grams, for example, instead of 0.5000 grams. So again, groups of three or four. For everyone, you need to complete the standardization titrations today so we can get rid of the iodate solution that we prepare. The thiosulfate you're going to still need on Monday because you're not going to finish, I don't think any of you, the entire lab today. What you're likely to get through is that standardization and then measuring the mass of your solid and preparing the two solutions, which let me describe that after I finish describing the titration. But the thiosulfate, you're likely going to have to store one member of your group of three or four. Just decide amongst yourselves who's going to keep it. If you know about parafilm, that thin stuff that kind of acts like saran wrap, you should know that it's not good enough to act as a barrier to water evaporating. In other words, if you don't want your solutions to possibly to disappear between now and Monday, you can't just put some saran wrap, some parafilm. You need to get the appropriate stopper. Also, we always are supposed to label anything that we store in case there's some kind of emergency and they need to come in and put out a fire. They need to know what kind of solutions and chemicals that they're dealing with. So just say in word form, not in formula form, sodium thiosulfate for that solution that you're going to store. So you got your two solutions. What do you do for standardization? Which, again, you're doing three times. You start with 1 milliliter of the potassium iodate, that standardized, that standard solution. You're going to transfer that to a beaker where you also add in 5 milliliters of water plus 6 drops of 2 molar sulfuric acid. Now, you're only going to be reacting this 1 milliliter, and then you're going to dispose of the solution. Particularly in 1A, when it's the first time that some people really discussing titration, there's this mistaken thought that if we have a solution that we're going to standardize, then what that means somehow is you react or analyze that whole solution. Well, no, especially in a redox titration, if we have done the standardization, which means react the solution, it's gone. It's reacted. There is no solution left. So we're only going to take a small portion of solution out, test that small portion, and then based on that stoichiometry, assume that the rest of the solution has exactly that molarity that we're going to calculate. So after we titrate this 1 milliliter of solution, it goes into the waste. It's done. What do we do to complete the titration? Because all this does is prepare. We add 2 milliliters of a 10% weight solution of potassium iodide. Why do we do this? Because we're making our own indicator, if you want to put it that way. See, in acid-base reactions, you can have indicators easily because you can have compounds that can change form depending on how much acid or base there is around. But for redox reactions, because it's electrons flowing around, it's not easy to come up with an indicator that can be oxidized and reduced at the right point compared to the reagents that you might have in your titration. So it's a little more difficult to come up with that kind of indicator system. Fortunately, what we can do in this case is be sneaky, because we could take the iodate, convert it 100% into iodine, which that's what this iodide does. I know the nomenclature gets a little tedious because you have iodate, iodide, and iodine. Well, we make iodine by the reaction of these first two things. And so your solution turns colors. Depending on how concentrated it is and your perception of the solution, it might be red or brown or yellow in color. But whatever that color is you see, it's due to iodine. So our end point is going to be to see the disappearance of the color of the solution. And that's going to happen when we titrate with thiosulfate. Now, there's something we can use to assist in this. And the reason for this is because the solution, the iodine solution, as it gets further and further along into the titration, as you've gotten rid of more of the iodine, the color is going to get lighter and lighter and lighter. And it can be difficult for the human eye to perceive between very, very, very light shades of yellow, particularly if you look around the room and you notice the walls kind of have a yellowish color to them already. So you might be fooled for what's really clear, what's a little bit yellow. So starch is used to enhance the color of your solutions. It'll react with the iodine in solution along with iodide to form a complex. That complex is purple in color, much more obvious when that color disappears. Now, when are you supposed to add the starch? Whenever you want to. Some of you, when you did this experiment before with the previous instructor, the instructor might have said, add it at the very beginning of the reaction. The only reason that might not be a good idea, it works, the only reason it would be worrisome is if you're not careful in your titration. Because it's awfully dark to begin with, and when it starts to get light enough that you see the color difference, well, you're already kind of towards the end of the titration. So if you're an impatient person and you add a lot of stuff at first, you may realize before it's too late, you've passed up that end point. But there's in theory no reason why you can't add the starch at the very beginning. You can add the starch at the end. You know, let's say you do the titration, you can see that yellow color disappearing. You think you see when that color has disappeared. So you can add the starch at that point. If the starch doesn't change colors, that means you were right, that you did reach the end point and everything's fine. If you add the starch and you can see a dark color appear, that means that it was a good idea that you added the starch because you weren't really quite done with your titration yet. The ideal way to use it is somewhere in between those two extremes, where you see the color disappearing, You've got a very pale yellow solution. Before you complete your titration, you then add the starch in. At that point, you continue. When you see the color disappear, you're at your end point. So the point of describing all that is to say, if you didn't add your starch, in theory, that's fine totally if you're confident that you really did reach that visual end point. Or it's fine to add the starch at any point. All right. Let me recap one more time what it is you need to get done today. There is going to be the one volunteer that I'll help that's going to make the iodate solution that's going to be used for the whole class. No pressure, it's just everything depends on it. Right? Because it's true, because if you get that solution wrong, all your other values are going to be wrong. So it's no pressure, just everything depends on it. That solution is going to be sitting right up here at the front. Please keep it stoppered when it's not in use, because again, if it's not stoppered, that means evaporation can occur, which means the concentration later on in the lab will be very, very slightly different than what we start with. Also, are you all familiar with what charging a burette is? Some of you yes, some of you no. So, particularly in acid-base reactions, we worry about the surface of glass because it's so water-compatible, because it's also compatible with H-plus ions and OH-minus ions. In other words, source of acid, source of base. So if you had an extremely basic solution that you coated the inside of a burette with, that burette might have a little lingering basicity that carries over to the next time you use it. That may not be as true in our reaction today, but why not take just a small precaution and wash our burettes out before we use them? And when I say burette, it is that fake microburette, which is really just a pipette with a syringe that's on top of it. But you can assume that maybe they were dirty from the last time they were used, and we're going to rinse out our solutions. Since we do only have a limited amount of solution volume, just the 100 milliliters for the whole class, what I'm going to do is I'll take a beaker and put it next to the main flask. I'll pour just a little portion of that solution out into the beaker, and that's going to be our wash beaker. What I mean by that is that you'll take your burette, put it into that beaker, fill it up, push it all right back out into that beaker again. Fill it up once or twice, just so that we expose that burette to the solution that we're going to be using. Since your burettes are all dry, if you don't go rush to wash them first, use this wash solution as the way of cleaning out your burette, which, yes, it might leave a little bit of, there might be a little concentration of something in there by the time all 30 of you use it, but still better than if we had not treated the burette at all. Now, don't use that beaker to then fill for your titrations. You're going to go ahead and use the volumetric flask. Now, this is not the best lab technique, what I'm about to describe. The only reason we're doing it is because we are going to do that wash and just also the logistics of handling that solution. What I don't want you to do is for each of you to come up and get your personal stash of that solution, you know, where you say, okay, I'll take a little bit back to my bench and get things done. But there's only the 100 milliliters of solution that we're making, so if each person takes a little stash, it's all gone. So because of that concern, and also I don't want to make a bunch of extra solution to then throw right down into the waste. That's why we're making this a little bit poor in technique. Where yes, once you've washed your burettes, you can take them and go ahead and stick them into that primary solution flask. Normally that would be a horrible idea, to take a burette and put it into a solution, because then you might as well just assume it's contaminated. But since I'm pointing it out, that's what the case would be. I'm then going to say, we'll ignore it just for simplicity's sake. And so after you've washed your burettes, go ahead and get your solution from that flask. All the solutions are going to go into the same waste container, because even if you had prepared the solution separately, you're titrating them. So there is an awful lot of waste we're going to generate today. Make sure that you, when you go back there, you don't just dump your waste into what waste bottle you see back there. Do make sure that it's got the correct experiment on the label. If it doesn't say the experiment name, it'll have compounds from this experiment like calcium nitrate, the sodium thiosulfate, potassium iodate, so on and so forth. So, one person makes the classroom standard. You have the various groups making the thiosulfate. You're going to titrate the thiosulfate with that primary standard, or other way around, at least three times. Get done with those standard runs today. Then, as far as the solution, the rest of what you're testing, you're probably going to have time to at least prepare the solutions and store them. How are you preparing the solution? Well, remember last time we made a precipitate by taking calcium nitrate and potassium iodate, reacting the two of them, filtering out that solid. The solid you needed to dry so that you could get its mass today so that you could get an accurate percent yield. So you should go ahead and get the mass of that solid. It then says in the directions to divide that solid into two roughly equal parts. No, you don't need to go measure it out on the balance because the solids should not completely dissolve. You're going to have excess. You want to make sure there's excess, but that means that if you just kind of eyeball the division, the 50-50, that's perfectly fine. So take that solid, break it up into the two groups. You're going to take the solid and in one beaker, put that in just deionized water. And then the other portion of the solid you're going to put into a beaker that has one of four potential solutions. There are four different solutions of calcium nitrate over there, and you pick one to put the second portion of your solid in. Now, that solution, make sure you write down the concentration because that will be important later on in your calculations. You're supposed to filter the solutions. But if at least you get to the point where you've divided up the solid and you've thrown it into the beakers to make the solutions, well, you could let them sit over the weekend for you to test on Monday. Or if you really are productive and you get done in time, you can go ahead and filter the solutions out. But you probably will not going to end up with time to do the titration of your solutions today. So are there any questions what you need to be doing in the lab? We do have one more day for this, but don't, even though you might be demolished from the exam, don't end lab early today to make your life difficult on Monday.